Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the program today, we're going to talk about the Republican spending bill that just passed the House of Representatives yesterday. The bill, as proposed, will have devastating consequences for the tens of millions of people who depend on food stamps, Medicaid, and other services. Cuts to these programs will fund tax breaks primarily for the wealthy. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the bill's tax cuts alone will add nearly $3.8 trillion to the federal deficit. But first, we're going to discuss sweeping investigations by ProPublica about how U.S. State Department and other diplomats have been pressuring developing countries, especially in Africa, to adopt Elon Musk's Starlink internet service. According to documents and interviews conducted by ProPublica, in recent months, senior State Department officials in both Washington and Gambia have coordinated with Starlink executives to coax, lobby, and in some cases, browbeat at least seven Gambian government ministers to help Musk. One of those cabinet officials told ProPublica his government is under, quote, maximum pressure to yield. To talk more about how the U.S. State Department is pressuring foreign countries on behalf of Musk and his business interests, we are very pleased to be joined by Brett Murphy, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on ProPublica's National Desk, where he writes about the government, companies, and power. Good to have you back with us, Brett.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
It's wonderful to have you, and thanks to you and your colleagues who worked on this truly revealing and very troubling investigation. So just to start with the basics, so much of this reporting revolves around Elon Musk's Starlink company. So for listeners not familiar, can you describe what Starlink does?
Yeah, it's an internet data provider. It's, you know, very similar to, you know, what you might get in the US for, you know, your regular Wi-Fi connections. All people can also connect their phones to them. So unlike, you know, those other providers that might use broadband or cable underground, this is all satellite. So it, you know, has the capability to reach more remote areas around the world, which has been part of the company's push now for quite some time.
Well, there's so much to talk about in your investigation, but I'd also note that Starlink was just in the news in terms of recent events where we had over the past couple of days a lot of coverage about the visit of South Africa's president to the White House. And in the middle of a press conference, we had one of the South African officials saying that they were looking forward to having Starlink in South Africa, which was treated as a gesture to cozy up to Trump. And South Africa's president also was apparently planning to offer Musk a Starlink contract ahead of the meeting with Donald Trump. So what do you make of this recent news about how Starlink is playing into diplomacy with South Africa in particular?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. South Africa was one of several countries that had up until now not granted Starlink a license to operate there. Elon Musk had criticized that quite a bit. The company had wanted to work there, and they were criticizing local laws and the country for not allowing them in. So this recent gesture by the South Africans, I think, is a pretty major development. We reported on similar exchanges in other countries where they recognized, you know, the countries recognized that it might be a good opportunity to curry favor with the administration by issuing Starlink a license. And this is documented in a lot of the State Department records and cables that we reviewed while we were reporting this story.
And Musk's push to be in South Africa does seem to be part of a wider coordinated effort, as you've documented in some of your reporting. The idea is to make Starlink the primary provider of internet services in developing countries, including those in Africa. And how much business right now are you aware of that Elon Musk is doing in Africa?
Oh, I don't have the count right in front of me, but it's well over a dozen countries, if I believe. It's kind of one by one. They've been ticking off, and it's been a very important part of their business, because, you know, this is a part of the world that does not have internet infrastructure, you know, throughout, like much of the developed world. I just looked it up. It's more than, I think, 15 countries at this point. And so sorry, it's just my dog. It's about 15 countries at this point, and you know, it's really important for them to get around. And they're also encroaching in Southeast Asia and the Middle East as well. There's markets there that I don't think exist in much of the West.
And you report that since Trump's inauguration, the State Department has intervened on behalf of Starlink in Gambia and at least four other developing nations. Previously, unreported records and interviews have shown. So how did you come to learn about these aggressive moves by State Department officials on behalf of Musk's company, a private business interest?
Yeah, so we, you know, spend much of the time, you know, just reporting by talking to people who are in positions to know about this type of thing. And, you know, this ranges from a lot of people in these countries themselves. A lot of our reporting for this story, you know, focused on how the local industry, how the local government was reacting to what was going on here. And, you know, they told us that it was making them extremely uncomfortable, that they thought the encroachment was, you know, out of line and was getting in the way, undermining their own sovereignty. And they had a lot to say about this. And then, you know, from there, it's just a matter of calling people, knocking on doors, and trying to prove, you know, what we heard as kind of a vague set of tips to begin with.
And how did you do that? How did you get access to State Department documents?
Well, a lot of this comes from people, I think, both inside and outside the government who come by these things. You know, I can't talk about it too much, but in short, you know, this is all, I think, a lot of people who are recognizing things that they see as abnormal. And, you know, it bothers them. It bothers them because they joined the Foreign Service, or they joined, you know, the government in some capacity because they, you know, are mission-driven folks, and they look at something like this as sort of, you know, a little bit opposite of what they signed up for. And I think it bothers a lot of people. So that's why they, you know, feel compelled to talk to us when we reach out.
Well, it sounds like you have essentially some whistleblowers, and also sounds like people who really feel that this is representing a break with what the State Department and diplomats would typically do. Can you talk about what the line might be? I mean, it may not be unusual to have diplomats wanting to further U.S. business interests, but where does it cross the line into helping a specific company and with particular tactics?
Yeah, so the you know, it's very normal for the State Department to advocate for U.S. interests, corporate interests abroad. You know, they will say, hey, the whatever, you know, soft drink industry is trying to open some factories here. We think it would be good for XYZ reason. And they would talk to regulators in that country, answer questions they might have, talk to those companies, have them, you know, address what those host countries' concerns might be. And from there, you know, they tend to work out, you know, deals and arrangements. This is very normal kind of advocacy that the U.S. embassies do abroad. This, we heard, was different for a couple of important reasons. One, in Gambia specifically, that the tactics were over the line in that it was, as you say, as it was interpreted, an extreme pressure campaign, sort of meeting after meeting with multiple ministers. Our ambassador there sent a strongly worded letter to the president of Gambia telling them that, hey, this agency, this regulatory agency, has refused to license Starlink. We think this is a problem. We want them licensed. They were approached by the company as well back when they were in Washington, D.C., during one meeting that, you know, this was one that was of particular concern to the Gambians. The U.S. Embassy in the Gambia laid out kind of all of the humanitarian aid that goes into the country that was kind of under review at the time, at the same moment they were discussing the Starlink license. And the Gambians took that as like a veiled threat, that if they were not to issue the license, then that, you know, humanitarian aid might be cut as well. And these were really important development projects. So all of this sort of amounted to what they considered really undue pressure. So that's one. That's like the tactics used. Secondly, it's who owns Starlink. Starlink is it's Elon Musk's company. Elon Musk, I think I have to tell your listeners, is one of the top advisors of the president, or, you know, at least was at the time. That, to a lot of the experts we talked to and consulted with for the story, said represents a kind of a glaring conflict of interest, or at least the appearances of one. And for that reason, you know, it would be very abnormal for the State Department to be taking such an active role in promoting the business interests of someone holding a position in the government.
We're speaking with Brett Murphy, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on ProPublica's national desk. He writes about government, companies, and power, and he also has done a very revealing investigative report on how U.S. State Department officials have been pressuring African nations to adopt Elon Musk's Starlink internet service. And you are listening to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines if you have questions about what our diplomats are doing to advance Musk's business interests, if you have experience with Starlink, if you have concerns, ideas about what should be done in response. We would love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us with any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. Brett, you were talking about what was being done specifically in Gambia. And my question for you is, why Gambia? It's one of the poorest countries in the world. About half the country lives on less than $4 a day. Why did the State Department single out this country to put pressure on to adopt Starlink?
Yeah, it's really hard to know. It's a question that was kind of nagging at us as well. You know, this is, as you say, a very small country. It's like 2.7 million people. They're extremely poor. It's an extremely poor country. So, you know, the natural question is why go through all the effort for what would be such a small market? And all I think we could say is that they, you know, Starlink wants to be in lots of markets, and this is just another market to be in. We saw them pressing government officials in other countries around Africa too. And there's not, you know, a very clear answer that came up as to why, other than, you know, it was just one of the ones that hasn't so far licensed Starlink, and they want to be licensed in as many countries as they can, I think.
And you mentioned other countries that were experiencing some of this pressure. Can you talk about what else has been going on in the region there in Africa?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, for example, the Cameroon, you know, the embassy there said that, you know, they might be able to show their commitment to, you know, the government of Cameroon might be able to show their commitment to Trump's foreign aid policy by letting Starlink have a license there. Lesotho said that they hoped, you know, the license there would reduce the levies, you know, the tariffs placed by the administration. Djibouti, likewise, you know, the embassy there documented multiple meetings that they had with the government of Djibouti. They were facilitating conversations. And likewise, I think Bangladesh too said that they were doing this early and often, working with Starlink to like educate the government. I think it was Bangladesh. I don't have it in front of me, but I'm pretty sure it was Bangladesh where the embassy even set up a conversation between the president of the country, or the prime minister rather, and Musk himself to discuss Starlink. So all of this is like facilitating, pressing, and working with the company to get it into markets that it's having trouble entering.
Well, we've talked a bit about some of the access you had to disgruntled employees who helped bring some of these documents to light for you and your team at ProPublica. And I also understand that ProPublica reporters are able to travel to the capital of Gambia to help piece together events. Can you talk about what you found when you were able to travel to Gambia? What was the outcome of that trip?
Yeah. So, I mean, a big challenge with this reporting was that we didn't know, like we had bits and pieces from our reporting here in Washington. We were talking with people, meeting people in person, but we still didn't have a key piece of this, which was how the Gambian government itself was interpreting these efforts. Because as you know, like interpretation can really matter when you're in a meeting, you know, what they were trying to say, what the details of what was said, when, who said it, all that stuff. These are really important facts. And we needed to know also just like what the importance of this industry was there. So there's a lot of things to fill in. We tried doing it over the phone, but we couldn't quite get there to a point we were comfortable with. So my reporting partner, Josh Kaplan, and I flew to Banjul. It's the capital of Gambia. And for about 2 weeks, we just met with government officials, industry officials, pretty much anyone who might know about what happened here, what has been going on, and had them fill in those gaps. They discussed, you know, what this pressure campaign looked like, and they spoke on the record about it, about how they viewed that one meeting in particular as a veiled threat. And like I was saying earlier, a lot of them saw this as, you know, undue influence by someone, you know, who has a position in the government. And, you know, it made them pretty deeply uncomfortable with what, all that happened.
If you're just joining us, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about an investigation by ProPublica into how U.S. State Department officials have been pressuring government leaders in nations in Africa to purchase and license Elon Musk's Starlink internet satellite service. And we are joined by Brett Murphy, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for ProPublica's National Desk. The phone lines are open if you have questions about how this type of foreign policy is being conducted, concerns about it, questions about Starlink and Elon Musk's role in U.S. foreign policy in general. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. And we do have an email in from a listener, Marie in San Francisco, writes, is Trump using tariffs to pressure these countries too? So Brett, is that part of the equation here? You've talked about how the Trump State Department officials were trying to leverage humanitarian aid in some cases, but are tariffs part of the leverage points here as well?
Well, I can answer in the reverse. So I can't say whether or not the administration was threatening tariffs or offering to remove tariffs if the countries agreed to license Starlink. I do not have evidence of that. I do not see evidence of that. On the flip side, though, I think Lesotho is, and that was reported by Mother Jones first, which is a neighbor of you down in San Francisco. First reported that Lesotho recognized that it might be a good opportunity to, as I was saying earlier, curry favor over the levy issue. So by offering Starlink, you know, they thought it might be able to help reduce the tariffs that the government had leveled on them before.
And the administration evidently says that they're not violating any laws by doing this, by applying pressure to advance, you know, one person's business interests, in this case, Elon Musk. Is there a conflict of interest here? And where is that line? And who's guarding that line?
Well, these are good questions. These are questions that have been asked in this context and many others, you know. The White House said that they do not tolerate conflicts of interest, and this does not represent one because Musk himself had nothing to do with these deals, with the Starlink deals. So therefore, you know, it's all kosher. On the other end, like in addition to that, they said, you know, this is an American company. Every American, patriotic American, should want to see the company succeed. And, you know, it's in U.S. interest to furnish these countries with this service, and it's going to help people in remote areas get access to the internet they wouldn't otherwise had, and that will bring them, you know, out of economic straits and into the developing world. I think that's the general argument. Whether or not it's good, I think, is besides the besides the point here. The point is whether or not this was represented a conflict of interest. Administration says no. The experts and officials within the government said it does represent a conflict of interest, and it's very abnormal. They actually hadn't seen anything like this before to this degree. So, you know, there's two arguments being made about it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the phone lines. We have Andy from San Francisco calling in. Andy, welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you. Just a quick comment that it's possible that they're setting up a big plumbing system for propaganda in the Fox News Network. It's been done before with Henry Ford making millions off of the war effort and other private companies. That's all I'll say, and maybe take a comment off the air.
Thank you, Andy, for that question. Yeah, is this part of an effort for propaganda?
I don't know. It's difficult to say. It's an interesting point. A lot of these countries, I should say, in Africa, like closed societies where they have state-run media, not the ones we were reporting on, but others like to have control over internet access. That's a fact. And Starlink has made the argument that, you know, they are for open access to internet, and what they're providing is an alternative to what a government might otherwise provide and then shut off all of a sudden. However, Starlink has also been accused of trying to prevent people in certain parts of Ukraine from getting access to the internet during that part of the war. So it's kind of a conversation that comes up a lot in different contexts, and it's difficult to know, and it's pretty motivation driven, which is getting inside the minds of people, which we can't really do as journalists.
Well, we have another caller, Parker in San Francisco, dialing in. Parker, welcome to your call. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the reporting on this. I was just wondering, I guess I'm still struggling to kind of understand the infrastructure of Starlink and kind of the benefits that it provides. So I was wondering maybe you could talk about that. I heard you just mention, for some of these countries that have state-run media, that, this kind of provides sort of independent thing. I know there are a lot of issues that come up with broadband media as well, and just kind of like the physical structures that broadband internet sort of provides. So I was maybe hoping if you could talk just a little bit more about some of the kind of like, I guess, infrastructural benefits of using a satellite sort of based internet instead of our current internet system.
Yeah, thank you, Parker, for that question. Brett, your response.
Yeah, so I'm not a technical expert, but I'll try my best. Basically, what exists in, and I'll use the Gambia as an example, and it might be similar to our infrastructure, but nowhere near as sophisticated, I would say. And they pretty much is just one underground submarine cable that travels the length of the country. The country is very narrow. It's built, it's pretty much just on the banks of the Gambia River in West Africa. And under that river is a cable. And then if you live in the remote areas, your phone service is trying to pick up little ping points or towers that pinged from that cable. That's how they get internet. It's all connected to one big cable. I think that's around the globe. Your access to that is only as good as your ability to connect to that cable or sometimes a nearby tower, I think. What Starlink does that's different is kind of sidesteps the whole cable infrastructure bit. And what you're doing there is you're pretty much buying it looks like a little solar panel, I think. And that connects to a satellite in the sky rather than through cables underground. And I think the idea there is that it's more reliable, and it doesn't matter where you are, how close you are to a cable or a tower, doesn't matter where you are, you'll be able to connect, to that satellite. I think that's the big difference. The question, though, that comes up is affordability. This question of, who can afford that solar panel, who can afford that service, is one that's for debate. And they, Starlink was criticized in, I believe it was Nigeria, for offering their services at one price, and then after they were licensed, hiking them up. So a lot of the folks in the industry in Gambia and other countries are quite worried about, the monopolization mm-hmm. of the industry, because that could lead to dramatic fluxes in price that come way over what they were originally promised. So these are some of the considerations there.
I appreciate those thoughts, Brett and Parker, for the question. We're just about out of time, Brett. So my last question for you is, what's next in the story? What else are you working on? What can we look forward to seeing next?
Yeah, so we're always interested in conflicts of interest in any government, not just the Trump administration. I wrote about the State Department under Biden. I'm going to continue writing about the State Department under Trump. So if there are things, your listeners would like to see us report or tips that they have, I'd recommend that they reach out to me. I'm on Signal at 508-523-5195. They can email me at brett.murphy@propublica.org.
Great. Well, we're so glad to have you on and for the important work you're doing to really expose what's happening well beyond our borders on behalf of private interests, in this case, Elon Musk and these African nations. Brett Murphy, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter on ProPublica's national desk. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to talk about the massive budget bill that just passed the U.S. House of Representatives and what it means for social services in this country. So stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.